Welcome to the Teamcast. I'm Dr. Preston Klein, Director of the Mission Critical Team Institute. Here, we discuss all things mission critical teams. These are teams of 4 to 12 people, indigenously trained and educated, who solve rapidly emerging, complex adaptive problem sets where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. With my colleagues and our guests, we bring you insights from combat zones to emergency rooms, dedicated to improving the success, survivability, and sustainability of these teams. We grapple with how to prepare for future events and how to develop language and frameworks to transfer critical, often unspoken, knowledge. Whether you're on a mission-critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible to help prepare you to perform when it matters most. Thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the Teamcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Teamcast. This is Dr. Preston Klein. Today, I am joined by Dr. Art Finch. And we are going to be discussing my recent paper called The Fourth Generation of Military Special Operations Selection and Assessment. It is located on our website. You can go there and download it. And since writing it, we've had some really constructive and positive feedback. And not only did we want to talk about the article, but the feedback has made me realize there was a bunch of things that are fairly obvious that I didn't include in the paper. And upon reflection, should have. There are things that need to get said out loud. And then since then, I've gone to see the last selection of the Five Eyes that I had to view. And so now I've seen in all five countries, UK, US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, I've seen all of the unit's selection of special operations or some part of it. And so I now have an opportunity to look back on all these things. The reason I brought Art in to talk about this question with me is because Art was one of the very first people I met in all of this. And going back in time to when Art was in the military, we met because I was going in just to look at instructor cadre. What my research is on primarily is on the tacit knowledge transfer problem and on education. And so my main focus was figuring out how instructor cadre can get better at sort of helping people understand what right looks like and feels like. But quickly, what happens is when you're in that business and you're sitting next to cadre that are working with students, you ask the question, where do these students come from? Like, why these students? And then what happens is you get pulled into the world of selection, which is a wild world. And this is 2007, because at that time, in some teams around the world, primarily the US, because the US uses more psychology than a lot of the other countries do, there was this really strong tension in some cases between the instructor cadre and the psychologists, which was the birth of this idea for this paper. Art, I'm going to bring you in and just, because I remember when I first met you where you were working, one of my first questions to you is, help me understand what's going on with these guys. Like, I don't quite get it. So Art, thanks for coming in.
That's an honor to be here, Preston. I'll never forget that first conversation. I had an office co-located with the JAG, which it was always kind of an interesting layout, the one office that nobody wants to be seen going in or out of for either reason, but there we were. And a good friend of ours came in and introduced you and said, I don't understand these people either, but Art will help you figure it out. And then he laughed and walked back out the door. And I remember just sitting down and it began a conversation about how in the world we end up with this place with the most amazing, unusual, unique group of human beings that has been assembled, and then trying to make sense of how we got there. And I'm so grateful for your work on this paper and just the thoughtful consideration of those processes and how we can make them better, because the world keeps moving forward. There are so many advances in technology and tactics, so many lessons learned from two decades of armed combat that all inform this process. And it's really, I think that we're at a key transition point right now in how these mission critical teams and special operations teams operate on the global stage, which is going to necessitate some changes in philosophy and perspective. And some of that's going to happen organically. How much better if we can do it deliberately and more effectively? And so I really appreciate the thoughts that you lay out in this paper and encourage people to download a copy and read it for themselves and see what they think.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. And I think about those early days a lot. And just to give the audience, you know, one of the things that Art and I hope we'll touch on today is, when do you change a selection? Because Art just referenced it. And it's not an obvious answer, quite honestly, because the question is, could the guys in World War II be effective today? even with all the technology change? And the answer is some of them could, some of them couldn't. And what we have to determine is, what are those cases they couldn't? Why? What's going on? And like I said, as we get into it, you'll see that some of the nuance here really matters. What I do want to do is I want to just start off by saying the things I should have said in the paper that I didn't, and I will include in the next paper. And I'm going to frame it in the following way. So this paper basically deals with two major models, historical models, which I call the psychological model and the rights of passage or rights of passage assessment model. The psychological model comes out of the early 1920s, first in Germany and then Britain and the UK. And it was done, designed and led by psychologists. But at the same time, there were other teams that were acting more of tribes, more of a rite of passage, an anthropological rite of passage, which is if you can demonstrate that you have what it takes to join our club, you can join our club, and we, as the elders of that tribe, will decide. And what ended up happening around 1988 is those sort of collided, those two systems collided and created some tension. And in that negotiation of which is better and which is worse, we tend to forget some things. And here are the two things I should have said. The first is that I make a statement in here that selection is about being revelatory. It's about choosing the right guys for the team. Let me back up one step. Selection is about producing enough people to sustain the team. Full stop. Forget about all the like psychology and the rites of passage and the culture and the tribes and the tridents and the berets. Forget all that for a second. Selection and assessment ultimately, at the end of the day, have to produce X number of bodies to sustain the teams, or the teams will go in decline. And that's actually happening worldwide. We'll talk about this, where legacy has become more important than the mission. And as a result, they're not producing the numbers they need to sustain themselves. That's a very dangerous place to be. And the second thing I wanted to say is, and this was pointed out to us by one of our colleagues, and this horrified me because I never want to be this guy. I'm actually anti this guy. But he pointed out that as I make this more explicit, these models for how to do this, I shouldn't get so smug that I forget that we still need savages. We still need misfits and juvenile delinquents. A nicer, more academic way to say that is that we still require a significant amount of neurodiversity or cognitive diversity. And part of that is that we don't have a really great measure for that. And so we shouldn't be so clever that we end up with this really nice bell curve that produces just the optimal candidate without variance of allowing in for, say, the weird. So, Art, I'll throw it over to you. But those were the two big things that I realized I should have said out loud.
Absolutely, Preston. And I failed to explain the whole reason that you and I met was I spent my 23-year career as a psychologist in the U.S. Army. I spent my first 3 years as a clinical psychologist working in hospitals and then fell down the wonderful weird rabbit hole of special operations doing assessment and selection and leadership development and team optimization and all of the other things that get put under the umbrella term of operational psychology within the military. I was the command psychologist at one of the units that Preston was visiting as he entered into this world. That's why we were linked up, was because I was kind of the keeper of the keys at the time for that particular organization for all things psychological, and got some of it right and some of it wrong and learned a lot of lessons along the way that we continue to share. So I absolutely agree, Preston, that, you know, if you take too scientific of an approach and you just end up with a bell curve of the Stepford perfect candidate, then you are going to run into issues that a more diverse approach would otherwise offer. And over the years, I've had the opportunity to participate in a large number of selection programs across the federal space and across the military space and even civilian law enforcement. And the programs that get it right are the ones that have the most balanced fusion between the two, that allow the cadre lived experience and expertise to be appropriately enmeshed with real psychological findings and results on psychological assessments and the wisdom that that provides, and they are more likely to get the right candidates and avoid hiring the wrong candidates and wasting time and effort and hopes and dreams and all of that. So I remember distinctly back in the 2015-2016 timeframe, there was a huge push across Army Special Operations looking at performance statistics and predictive analytics and using machine learning to predict which candidates were most likely to fail and which were most likely to succeed. And we spent a year pulling in all kinds of archival data, putting it into spreadsheets. And we had a brilliant research psychologist who happened to be part of our team at the time who understood machine learning and started running some basic machine learning algorithms and using artificial intelligence to predict who was going to succeed and who was going to fail. And there was a change of command out at Camp McCall where we run the core special operations assessment and selection for the Army for special forces, psychological operations, civil affairs, and related type endeavors. And there was a change of command for the leadership out at Camp McCall that ran all of the boards and led the decision-making on most of those processes. And we came in with our dog and pony show and all of our charts and all of our statistics and all of our findings. And we laid it all out and ran through every candidate and gave them cutoff scores and sat back to bask in the glory of it. And this new commander, he sat there thoughtfully and it just, the silence just hung pregnant. It felt like forever. It was probably only 10 seconds, felt like 10 minutes. And he sits up and he goes, "I've been told since the change of command that I'm the commander here." And that would suggest that somewhere along the line, some faith has been put in me to make the best decisions for this organization moving forward. And I see absolutely nowhere in this process my opportunity to be that decision maker. So I'm going to ask you to leave and come back when you figured out how to keep the human in the science.
Yeah.
It was such a pivotal learning moment for me because I've learned those lessons over time. I'd sat on thousands of boards at that point. And a lot of times it was personality driven, how well that balance was executed. We call it the art of feedback to the board because depending on the flavor of the board and the makeup of the personalities that were on it, as a psychologist, we had to be very careful how we framed things. If we came in too hot and too overbearing, then invariably a sergeant major would be like, "Well, the psychs are taking too much control of the board and we need to have some say in it." And sometimes we would be asked to leave or asked to only share straight up observations and no opinions or professional conclusions. And really, wisdom and experience came from getting scuffed up many times over the years and figuring out the art of finding that balance and helping organizations find that balance. And it was a painful memory to sit in that room and have that commander kick us out because we had overcorrected. We had leaned in too hard on the things that we understood, the language that we spoke, and we had left him and his cadre out of the process at that point.
So just a couple of terms for our audience. When we talk about psychologists or we talk about instructor cadre, what they're technically called is communities of practice. They're a group of people who have a particular expertise that focus and create language around and experience around a particular thing. When you put communities of practice together and you orient them towards actually doing something in concert, it becomes a community of praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. And this paper is recommending the blend of the communities of practice that actually get us what we want to do. As an outsider, because my background is in education, I have seen what Art's talking about around the world multiple times. But not only that, in this research that I did on this paper, it turns out that when the Germans first did it, what they were trying to do is they're trying to balance the aristocracy, the Prussian on one hand that used to control the officer corps, and the rising Nazi party on the other hand. And what they wanted was a middle lane that would keep them independent. And so it just so happened that in 1879, the first university for experimental psychology was created in Leipzig, Germany. And so they had all these out-of-work psychologists around. They're like, "Let's get those guys in." But you got to remember that psychologists come from the university. They are not military people. They have not been indoctrinated into the military, and they think a very particular way, which is why they're desirable. They're outside thinkers. They're not bought into the Kool-Aid. And so what happens is this gets repeated for the UK, for the British in 1938, and then again in the OSS. And in all three cases, once they create enough operators who had gone out and gone to combat and come back as instructor cadre who felt true ownership of what the role and the job and the culture was, one of the first things that happened is the psychologist got fired in all three cases. And what I've seen is this over the years, this pendulum swing between When the cadre get full authority, it goes bad, and I'll explain why that is. But when the psychologists get too much power, that also goes sideways in actually some very historical and predictable ways. And the reason, one of the reasons I wrote this paper is I was just tired of it. I was like, guys, let's just, why don't we all just collectively acknowledge that our strength is our weakness. You will pursue your strength so far as it will destroy you. So how about we try to create some mechanisms to balance those tensions, as opposed to having them at war with each other, be fuel for creativity. And so I wanted to say all that back so that the audience had a place to go, but also to know this isn't unique to individuals or personalities. These are cultures that are in tension with each other.
Agreed. I remember you made me think of a conversation I had in the middle of Afghanistan. I was the psychologist for the 75th Ranger Regiment at the time, and I was deployed. And one of the commanders I was working with is at the time Colonel Paul LaCamera. And we were having a very in-depth conversation one night about this very topic, about how heavy of a hand psychologists should play in the decision-making process. And I don't know if Paul LaCamera is the person who came up with this saying, but this was the first time I heard it. And he said, "Doc, I just want to know if they're in the band of excellence."
Yeah.
And I have all kinds of time for differences once I know that they're in that band of excellence. I love the reframing that provided for me as an academic and as a psychologist, being able to think about the fact that all of my lovely statistical norms and scientific theories can help define some of those boundaries, but so do the cadres, and that the combination of the two help us end up with this bolus of individuals, any one of whom theoretically could be the right person, with lots of room for variability and diversity within that. How that ended up playing in reality often differed, but theoretically it was a nice way to reframe it, and I've always appreciated that construct of the band of excellence.
I had these similar experiences right throughout my research over the last almost 20 years now. I was down with Naval Special Warfare looking at one of their selections, and I was at the time not a fan, and I'm still challenged by it. I have complex thoughts about it, but the day one physical fitness test. So every team has a day one physical fitness test, and many of them, it is a go, no go decision. So if you don't pass that, you're going home. And the rationale is that it's an opportunity to see if you can prepare. My problem with that is that's not quite accurate, meaning that if a officer is, say, working for a four-star general, there is no time to repair. Their life is not their own. Or if they have the flu or their mom guts, there's a bunch of reasons where that 20-30% that we see worldwide of failures on day one PFT is not just because of lack of preparation. It could be a variety of things. And so I just personally think it's not the greatest tool, because the one thing I know that I can improve are push-ups and sit-ups. That's the one thing I know I could actually control for. So it doesn't seem like a good metric to me. And then one of the guys turns to me, who's frustrated with me because culturally it's very important to the teams. Like, it's sacred because they all had to do it and you have to do it, because show us that you're thinking about it, your head's in the game and you want to be here. And he turns to me and he says, "Preston, let me ask you a question. That kid who fell out day one of that PFT, what if they were just unlucky? Shouldn't we be testing for luck? And can you have a measurement for luck?" And I realized in that moment that all cultures, they work in the extraordinary world. They work in life and death. And there are things about that science has yet to really understand, and that we need to leave room for those things. And he was right. I couldn't measure it. And luck is a thing, even if I can't explain it. And that's always been a really good, humbling thing for me to say, don't get so clever, Preston, that you outthink luck.
100%. And something else that I would add to that is that PT test, it's come to hold value for me over the years, even though I've been required to do that several times for different selection programs throughout my career. And I love running, but I absolutely hate running as fast as I can for 2 miles. I think it's ridiculous. I would never do that on purpose. However, over time, I came to value that initial PT test as the last point for a graceful exit.
Yeah.
For somebody who had other complications in life. Their wife was just diagnosed with something. Their husband just found out he had to deploy. Any number of reasons why people who signed up for something with the best intentions suddenly find themselves in less than ideal circumstances. And it creates an opportunity to not voluntarily withdraw and therefore never be allowed to come back, which is often a standing policy for these selection programs, but to fail and be given a chance to try again in the future when circumstances might be right. And it also allows them to create a mythology around how that exit happened. Oh, they didn't count all my push-ups. I did all of them, but the grader was just being a jerk. They're just being gatekeepers or whatever mythology they needed to create to live with themselves as they prepared for the next opportunity.
And what's really interesting about that, right, is that that's a great example of a blend of psychology and culture and psychology and existential identity and tribe. And this idea that it's not just about the numbers, but it's also about who that person is in that moment and who they're becoming and what decisions they need to make in that moment. One of the things that I wrote was, why do we do selection? That's the first question. And some teams don't. This is important for people to understand. Some teams have a selection model, which is just a training model where there is attrition. So in other words, you don't show up to do a 7-day selection before you do training. You just go into training. And if you make it to the end of training, you're in. Or you get voted on to decide if you're in. And so that's more of an attrition model. And by the way, from 1952 to 1988, that was the Green Beret model. That was it was a model of attrition. It was a training model where as long as you did pretty well and got to the end of it, you were probably going to get a Green Beret. It wasn't until 1988 that they reintroduced psychological assessment permanently. And so what I will say is that the reason that you want to do selection is a revelatory process. It is to select. And training is not to select. Training is to train and develop. The big mistake that most teams make when they get frustrated or the instructor cadre feels though they've lost power is that they'll use training as a second selection. So if we're just doing a selection and doing it properly, it's a revelatory experience. And that is to say, it's to reveal the candidate to the cadre. Do we want them? It's also to reveal the candidate to themselves, to really look at themselves sitting in search, torture, or buds and go, do I really want this? Can I do this? Like, is this really part of me? And then it's to reveal the tribe to the candidate. Do I want to hang out with these folks? Are these people that I want to go to war with or not? And those three things really matter in selection, and all of them matter. And too often, we are too fixated on the do we want them that we forget the other two.
That's one of those things that is not as explicitly stated in this paper, which a couple of very thoughtful individuals provided some feedback highlighting this. And it's funny because it's something that we understand and talk about enough that we just kind of tacitly understand it, but yet we failed to highlight that specifically. So I think that's an incredibly important point that you're making, that all three of those things and then a whole bunch of subtext around all of them are involved in that process.
100%. So now the mechanism. So now you've got this person, you've decided to do a selection. What are you actually looking at? You're going to make them go through a series of events. And basically the way that broke out is that traits, attributes, and aptitudes. And these are all personality characteristics or physical characteristics. And these matter because often when you hear people in debates about selection, they're often mixing up these terms or they're overstretching the strength of the terms. And so traits are consistent patterns of behavior. If you've taken a NEO, if you've taken a personality index, any of that stuff, that's what that is. It's predictive things we've looked at, agreeableness, conscientiousness, things that we can measure pretty predictably. What the last 20 years of war taught us, however, is that they are not as permanent or predictive as we thought. They still are for the majority, but there are times where major life events will actually move the needle on that. And that people evolve, they change over 20 years. The second one is attributes. And the difference between traits and attributes, even though they get often mingled, they are different. Traits are measurable, quantitative, we can put a number to them. Attributes are like singing ability or sense of humor or attitude or trust. Or courage. These are things you can't put a number to. Well, no one gets a 7 for courage. That's not the way it works, right? And so what that means is that they're qualitative. They are observed either directly or the absence of them becomes apparent. That is something where that's a cultural factor, meaning that particular tribe lies, cheats, and steals a certain way. And special operations, I'm not exaggerating, they are designed to lie, cheat, and steal. It is their job to do bad things, to make problems for the enemy. But there are boundaries around that. There are boundaries of what is right and what is wrong. But not all of them can be reduced to mathematics. Some people will tell you they are. I would argue vehemently they cannot, and they're misleading you. But what we can do is create some really interesting qualitative assessments that can get you really good data, which is really the collective voice of the instructor cadre, representatives or elders of the tribe, saying, hey, yeah, this person meets our definition of weird enough. And then the last one, and I'll turn it over to Art, is aptitudes. And aptitudes are simply like, can you run fast? Can you swim fast? Can you do these things? And so, and the hard truth is this, Preston Klein, no matter how much heart I have, will never be a ballet superstar, right? Art will tell me, not with that attitude, but no, legitimately, even with the right attitude, it's not going to happen for me. Opera's out too, by the way. I was not born with that range of vocals and no amount of training getting them for me. And so we often, we get tied up in the Rudies of the world, the people who have all the heart in the world, and you would work on a team with them every single day, but they can't get across the finish line under the time you need them to. All of this matters because selections, if done well, are a microcosm of the temporal and stressful environment of the actual mission. So let me say that again. A selection designed well is a mimic of the actual experience you'll have out on the X, out on the mission. So you have to be able to learn fast enough, move fast enough, work together, communicate fast enough at the same rate of learning, rate of communication that will occur on the X, or you can't do the job. Full stop. As the world gets more even technologically complex, and we'll talk about when do you change selection, this starts to become actual real pressure on some selections now because it's starting to change the kind of person that's being required to go to places like Ukraine.
Yeah, agreed. I had a thought come to mind when you were talking about the qualitative nature of attributes and that really a lot of the reason it's so hard to quantify is because it's so often traits abound in a current context.
Yeah, and the culture.
Right, and the culture. And so I could have somebody who has a great sense of humor, but being a comedian at a funeral is the wrong context for that.
Yeah.
And one additional powerful component of the most effective selection programs is when the candidates live on top of, with, and around and beneath each other for at least a week, and then the program uses peer evaluations.
Yeah.
Because you end up with an interesting reflection of not only the lived experience of the other candidates in the room, this is what it was like to interact with this human being. Yes, I could drive across country with this guy and not kill him by the time we got there. And it's also them trying to wear a lens, which is evolving over the course of selection, on what they believe this culture is that they're trying to join.
Yeah.
And what they believe the attributes are that will be valued and what they believe right looks like from there. I'm not in the organization yet, but I really want to be. Here's what I thought it was when I started. A week later, this is now what I think. And all of that weighs in on trying to capture and catalog and categorize the attributes and put a number of at least a class ranking on their fellow classmates. And so you just made me think of the whole peer process and how important that can be as part of the capturing that piece of the individuals living with other individuals under that microscope and all of the different tendrils that snake into that.
We advocate a lot for peer reviews. And the only caveat that I will say to anyone's listening is, just as a reminder, don't ever collect bad data. And here's what I mean by that. Let's say there's 20 people in selection, right? And I'm spending most of my time on a team with Art and a couple of other people, but I've never spent any time with Fred, Joe, and Harry. Don't ask me to rate Fred, Joe, and Harry because you just get bad data. What they're going to do is put a 7. And then you'll get a bunch of 7s that don't mean anything, but actually come to cause problems at the board because that ends up as a number. So really make sure you're doing peer assessments on people that have actually spent time with each other. My other thing is a friend of Art and mine who passed away a few years ago was a guy named Bill Dean. And he was one of the persons that helped me write my first articles for JSOC. And he was in special operations at a very elite level. And I was getting pushed by some psychologists to adopt a particular frame of attributes that had been studied for many years. And it was Bill's team's attributes. And so I went to Bill because they said, look, there's 40 years of data here. It's a good data set. Just use those attributes and then we can benchmark them off that data. And there was some allergic reaction. There was some hesitation within me. So I went and took a long walk with Bill Dean. And Bill said, here's the problem that you're having. Let's say our attributes were honor, courage, and commitment. We evaluated honor, courage, and commitment very differently from a bunch of farm boys from Idaho going to Vietnam than we do for a modern day kid from New Jersey going to Iraq. And it sounds like they should be the same, but to just Art, times changes, values changes, complexity changes. So even though they're the same attributes, they're not in some ways because they get interpreted by each generation a little bit differently. Is that fair, Art?
Yeah, completely agree with that. Yep.
Let's talk about attrition. So a lot of teams make the mistake that their job is to create attrition because it's a selection program. There's a couple of different ways that people attrit out of selection, and I'm going to just give them to you. There's drops on requests or voluntary withdrawals, and that's a person says, not for me, can't do it, whatever. There's injury or medical drop or personnel issue drop. That is, hey man, I broke something or my family's broke, I got to go. There is straight up failures. So a failure could be, it could be a safety thing. It could be a misfire. It could be muzzling. It could be unsafe. It could just be you're not doing the things we need you to do. Then at the end of selection, there's often a vote. Not always, but in some selection programs, at the end of it, not everybody who makes through gets selected. There's a board. And in some cases, there are just non-selects, people who've made it through selection but aren't selected. And then the last one happens later, which is that people are selected but then fail out of the follow-on schools. And what we often see with that is when selections become just beat downs, they become less intellectual and less screening for intellectual capabilities. And then we see a more of a greater attrition in the follow-on schools. Teams and individuals, so candidates and the teams, are better off in a drop-on request scenario. Everyone is better served by that scenario. It's better for your marketing. It's better for your word of mouth. It's better for that individual and better for the team. Arts, any thought on that?
I agree. And I've worked with a couple of organizations that lean in hard on that, where even a drop-on request does not mean that you are an individual of poor character and terrible upbringing and can never come back. When people know that they can take that exit and still have an opportunity to come back, it's a really big deal. And a couple of programs I've seen lean into that, they have an out-processing counseling where they express gratitude to the candidate for showing up in the first place. And they ask them what they learned and they ask them what they would change. And if there's anything they could have done to prevent them feeling like they needed to leave. And it's a very open and honest and transparent conversation. And the intent behind that is, one, to learn and help their process evolve, but to also send that person back out into the world saying, I wasn't able to stay, but I cannot wait to get back there. And you should go too, right? It becomes a really powerful way to extend culture and impact out into the bigger organizations that these recruits come from and these candidates come from.
So I want to shift us towards the two different communities of practice, the psychologist and the instructor cadre. The psychologists, for the most part, represent the academy, the university, the science of the thing. And the instructor cadre are basically elders or representatives of the tribe, the team that people are going to. And they're representing the needs and interests of the tribe. The psychologists are often representing the needs and interests of the organization. That's not always true, but just generally speaking. And what I've noticed after almost 20 years is, depending on how much the organization invests in both the instructor cadre and the psychologist will remarkably change the efficacy or how well selection works. For example, Art is actually also a ranger. Our friend, Dr. Morgan Banks, is not only a psychologist, but also a Green Beret. And so when you have psychologists that have had some experience downrange, and that can mean a lot of things. It can mean in surgery in hospitals. It can mean a lot of things. But they understand a little bit of the life. It actually makes the conversations a little bit easier, and there's a better shared understanding. On the other side of the house, you have teams around the world that use selection as a professional development opportunity where they're developing people because doing well as instruction will make you a better leader, and therefore you get first shot at team leader or helps you with your promotions and officers. We often, however, we'll see teams that use the instructor cadre as the dumping ground for misfit toys. And so the operators who are broken in some way, physically, emotionally, something going on, and the squadrons don't want them at the moment. The teams don't want them, but they don't want to fire them. Where they'll actually sit them is in the instructor cadre, and that's usually a recipe for disaster. And so those are those tensions between getting the right psychologist and the right instructor cadres to come together to perform this different thing.
Fortunately, in military special operations, for the most part, this hasn't always been the case, but for the most part now, psychologists are uniform-wearing, patch-bearing members of the organization. And how well they are integrated and accepted into that organization often comes down to them and how they interact with the personalities of the tribe, the level of compatibility. But it also is at times structural. And this is a leadership decision where I've seen some organizations who have the psychologist as part of the commander's special staff report independently to the commander. And those are usually where I see the most balance between these two communities, because the psychologists are seen as having an equal seat at the table. In other organizations, and by a lot of military doctrine, for TO&Es and other things like that, the psychologist will be aligned under the surgeon because you're medical. That's a medical thing. You're a licensed medical provider. Therefore, even though that's maybe not what you're doing, you belong to the surgeon. And whenever that distinction is made and highlighted, it ends up having a significant impact on how that psychologist is able to navigate, how the cadre utilize them. And rightly, somebody else in leadership has drawn a line in the sand for them and put some boundaries around it. And so it's a really simple structural thing that has a huge impact.
It's important to just stop and note that when we're talking about psychology in the military, we actually mean a couple of different kinds of psychology, and we should say that out loud. So historically, this falls under the category of operational psychology. However, operational psychologists can come from clinical psychology, industrial organizational psychology, performance psychology, positive psychology. And so what ends up happening, though, is that they are trained in slightly different ways, and they're asked to do the same thing in some cases. And what's important to know about the discipline of psychology is that it is a pathological model traditionally, which is to say, much like medicine, it's designed to look at, you are broken, how can we fix you? And as a result, what it's very good at doing is finding the red candidates, the dark red candidates you do not want. And so a psychologist comes to you and says, this is a dark red candidate, you should get him off the property. You should get him off the property. Where psychologists will sometimes go wrong, but usually not for bad intentions, simply because they want to contribute, is that they'll start trying to conjecture on what right looks like, what a great candidate looks like. And that's when sometimes the wheels can come off, because they're not taking the time to ask the cultural questions about that. And they're going a little bit beyond their science. And that depends entirely, again, on the personality. But if we look at it just writ large, and so I'm picking on your field, Art, so you should fight back.
So I actually do need to fight back a little bit just with a course correction.
Yeah.
Within the military, the only psychologists in uniform who are assigned to combat units are licensed doctoral level psychologists, clinical or counseling psychologists.
Got it.
So sports psychologists, industrial organizational psychologists, other performance type psychologists, that people that have psychologists in their name would never be called operational psychologists, nor would they ever call themselves operational psychologists. So just an important distinction.
Got it.
Lest we create an allergic reaction amongst people that we really want to integrate with and be as helpful as possible. So that is an important distinction. But your point about the pathology model is 100% real. And I will say that was probably the most rewarding part of my career shift, going from being a clinical psychologist to an operational psychologist. It took a few years of readjusting my lens from one that was looking for pathology to one that was looking for health, and trying to figure out how to capitalize on it and optimize it rather than just see what was wrong and highlight that and get rid of it, cut it out, or try and be helpful to it. Now, that's not to say that there weren't problems that showed up. Human beings are human beings. Life gets complicated, right? So there were plenty of times that my beret was tilted in a clinical direction, but that wasn't necessarily the role that I was there for. And I've been eternally grateful for that transition from a pathology model to more of a health and positive psychology model.
So I really appreciate the correction, because it brought up a thing that now I just realized. The reason I said what I said was that every once in a while, I get the opportunity internationally to sit and observe boards, selection boards. And over the last, say, 10 to 20 years, we've seen the rise of human performance. And with the rise of human performance, we've seen the rise of performance psychologists, sports psychologists. And because now what we're often seeing is human performance folks are being brought to the boards. And they are speaking both as human performers, but also in some cases as psychologists. I had not realized that differentiation that you're talking about, because as an observer, it's hard to tell the difference between what they're saying and the clinical psychologists next to them are saying. And that's sort of part of the point of this discussion, which is there is right now some ambiguity on all of the people that want to be of service to our folks that go from chaplains to human performance to psychologists to social workers to coaches. And there is confusion as to what everyone's role is, who can be effective and why they can be effective, and when perhaps that's not the person you actually want to be talking to. Is that a fair sort of explanation?
Yes, and you highlighted a really important and valid point, because when you talk about communities of practice, you just described multiple communities of practice that are under that umbrella of psychologist.
Yeah.
And there is just as much opportunity for collaboration as well as dissent and barriers between all of those communities of practice within psychology. The most successful organizations that I've seen that have the best integration with psychologists, using that term loosely and in an encompassing way, are the ones where the psychologists within that practice have successfully navigated and resolved any tribal issues around their individual communities of practice.
Yep.
And it tends to be more integrated and more involved, and it's very healthy. When I see a lot of stovepiping and people vehemently defending their role within their lane versus figuring out how to integrate and play well with others, then it creates a lot of drama that ends up being reflected in that division between the cadre and the psychologist. And I get why it's confusing, because most of the time, if you say psychologist, if you are well-liked, you'll be called doc. Like, yep. It's a term of endearment, and I think that's a very healthy thing. And so it can certainly be confusing. And if it's confusing to you as an outside observer, it's probably equally confusing for a lot of the people who are gunslingers sitting on the board who have to make some of these decisions. So it's a really valid observation.
I know how things are going with a team, because if they say, hey, doc, it's an affirming thing. But if they say, look, professor, that's usually not an affirming thing. So it's these little things that you learn, like, check, I see where I am on the board right now. But let's just talk technically right now about the differences between these two community of practice, instructor cadre and psychologist. One is where they source their knowledge. And just think big now for a second. Psychologists source their knowledge from what's called Latin a priori, which is to say knowledge that can be expressed through writing. It can be written down and shared. Instructor cadre primarily, as we've discussed, have tacit knowledge or a posteriori. I can never say it right. But it's that knowledge that comes from experience. And this matters because that kind of knowledge gets communicated two different ways, the emic and the edic. When the psychologist's like, well, I think he has a 0.5 on this scale, right? The psychologists are talking in an edic language, which is that person's the top quartile. That's an edic language. Emic language is, I don't like the shape of his head, or I don't like the sound of his voice. They're not really saying that. That's code for a variety of other things, but it comes across as dumb. It comes across as illiterate and uninformed. At MCTI, we spend a lot of time trying to get cadre their own language so they can express in an emic way their what we call funds of knowledge, their collective experience, their lived experience that is actually really valid and really important, but sometimes can lead them astray if it's not interrogated. And so just like the academic knowledge that has to get interrogated, so does the tacit knowledge. It can't just be like, oh, I know what right looks like and that guy sucks. Well, no, because there's a whole bunch of biases in there that you're not paying attention to. But sometimes you're absolutely right. And that's the tricky part of it.
Agreed. And referencing my comment earlier about the art of feedback to boards, the most successful psychologists are the ones that figured out a shared language or how to use the phraseology and terminology to discuss the things they were seeing rather than quartiles and percentiles and sequelae and a lot of other scientific jargon. These are very bright people, but that's not the language that they use on a daily basis.
Yeah, and now I want to talk, Art, about when both models go off the rails. And they both go off the rails for different reasons, but if left unsupervised, they will go off the rails. And I've been picking on the psychs first, so I'm going to pick on the instructor cadre this time. And we see that there's a couple of different ways in which instructor cadres will have some real problems. And the first is excellence creep. We've all heard of that. And that is that you have to remember that in most cases, the instructor cadre are not permanent staff. They're rotated in on like a 12-month to 18-month, 24-month basis, and then rotated out. It may be that the last time that they observed selection was when they themselves were in selection. And they're coming being like, okay, I'm choosing someone to go to war with me. This person has to be amazing. And they have what's called memory bias. In their mind, their selection was the hardest thing they've ever done. So therefore, this selection should be harder, right? So instead of there being need to be 20 pull-ups, that person, that's the minimum. They really should be doing 22. And so you see this little excellence creep until no one can complete it because no one can actually achieve those things except this one superhuman who's kind of a sociopath. So you have to be really careful of that. The other two things that happens is that one of the big lies that gets told in special operations is this. Hey, you've been overseas, you've been on combat, you've been going through all these things. Come back to the schoolhouse and you'll have some time with your family. And it's the biggest lie because that's not what happens. What happens is they're home long enough to do their laundry and disrupt the family life, right? And then they're at the schoolhouse working crazy hours under tremendous stress, doing a job they don't feel confident in. So it's kind of a miserable time. And that gets actually taken out on the sort of the candidates. And then what happens is that those things operating in together, the excellence creep and the instructor burnout, have a cumulative effect where you end up graduating less people in selection. And so what ends up happening is that you're supposed to keep 10 people graduated a year in order to sustain the team, and you're graduating two. You can do that one time, maybe even two times. But the third time, what's going to happen is the generals, the admirals, the chiefs will step in and be like, that's enough of that. And then all of a sudden, you lose all your authorities and you think everyone's trying to take away your standard, lower your standards, and kill your culture. And that's not what's happening. What's happening is things were left unattended, things got out of hand, and now we're here. This paper is designed to look at when it goes off the rails. But as a reminder to everybody, the reason we're able to produce extraordinary people around the world consistently is because most of these programs work really well. And for long periods of time, this is not a wholesale thing to say that psychologists are bad or cadre is bad. These are examples of when great systems, what are the stressors, what are the competing tensions, and where are the potential weaknesses that might defeat them over time and little by little. And so this isn't a condemnation of selection and training. I'm a huge fan of it all. I think it's amazing. It's over 20 years trying to identify those areas where will starts to go off the rails if you don't pay attention to it. Art, is that fair?
Yeah, fair. Completely okay. Agree.
The two other ones, before I go to psychologists, that I wanted to bring to your attention is there's two other ways that we'll see organizational drift. And I've named them diffusion creep and logistics creep. Diffusion creep is what happens when you have a unit that started out with, say, 60 operators, and now it's 2,000 people, and you've got techs, you've got psychologists, you've got sports psychologists, you've got a whole bunch of people. And a whole bunch of people have their fingers in the pie, but they don't necessarily understand the pie. They're well-meaning people, good-hearted people, and from their expertise, want to improve things. And so I was recently at a selection where there was a particular stand, and the stand was designed to see how people navigated truly ambiguous or uncertain, highly kinetic events. A well-meaning person who was running that stand from a technology and a logistics place said, man, these instructions are always so confusing. Let me get into the script and clean them up so we can give better instructions to the students, which in their good heart was like a kindness. But it defeated the purpose of the stand. So the follow-on stand, when they were getting interrogated, had all the right answers. And we're like, what is going on? How did this happen? And they had to go back upstream to look at this. And I've seen that more and more as teams get bigger, that people with really good intentions are allowed access to the design in ways that are contrary to the actual underlying design. The other creep that happens is what I call logistics creep. So Art Nile design is amazing selection, right? And we'll do it in collaboration, as we do with everything, with everybody. And then we'll be like, yes, this is great. And then we'll hand it to the cadre, and the cadre will be like, this is a really good idea, but we can't get the truck till Thursday, and we can't get access to that facility, and Frank should have really run this, but he's on leave. The logistics of it will start to fracture the design of the selection, but not all at once, just dribs and drabs over time. And unless you have somebody looking at the big picture, you don't understand how it creeps away from you, like excellence creep. It's not a one-and-done situation. It's not one person just suddenly breaks it. It's these little tiny corrections. And the last thing I'll say is, with all of this, is that guarding against those things shouldn't inhibit your ability to innovate. So I'm not suggesting that things shouldn't change. They should change, but they should be changed intentionally, not by accident.
Absolutely. And I'd never heard either of those terms, but I can think of many situations to which either or both of them apply. And at the risk of stirring up a hornet's nest, you lead me to think of situations over the last 20 years where the performance of the soft units in combat was so highly regarded that the demand went through the roof.
Yes.
And the demand was so high that it was literally impossible to meet.
Yeah.
They couldn't get enough people through. And what I saw during that time was, for both cadre and the psychologists that were involved, it really went back to a pathology model of, if there's something wrong with this person that's bad enough that we can't take them, figure it out through physical standards or psychological standards. If they're below this score on these tests, historically, that's been a bad thing. So anybody who scores lower than that gets to talk to the shrink. If you score below this, then we might give you one more chance, where before it was a hard drop, now you get one more chance in 2 days to recover, and now you try again. And obviously, people who are in the community at the time have a hard time with that, because you immediately start hearing you're lowering the standards. And it just raises so many complicated issues around diffusion creep in a potentially negative direction because of logistics. In this case, literally the number of people available to even try and put on whatever hat or patch they're trying for, to join whatever unit. So I don't know if you even want to wander down that path at this point, Preston, but that was where my mind went as you were talking about it.
Yeah. So another way I keep myself humble with all this stuff is a reminder that when all of these teams were first stood up, there wasn't a selection, and they still went off and did great things. Now, some of them caused some real problems back at home, for sure, which is why we need a selection. But let's all remember that if the zombies attack tomorrow or the aliens landed and we had to suddenly get 50 teams, we'd do it. And they'd probably do pretty great. I think that the teams we're talking about, the people that want to join these teams, for the most part, are good humans who will get it done. They just might not get it done the way you think they should. And so that's just a gentle way to say, just deep breaths, everybody. But there's some blood spilled at these selection boards. And my motto really is it a red? And if it's not a red, then it's a green, right? That is my motto. I don't believe in yellows. I believe, is the person red? No, then put him through. You have a mechanism to get rid of them later. Just put them through. If you don't have the resources to do that, we have to have another discussion. That's a different discussion. But if you're asking me, get rid of yellows. And by the way, for the people that don't know, often people will talk about the greens, everybody wants them. The reds, nobody wants them. And the yellows are, we're kind of confused. Their numbers are sort of mixed. We all have mixed views and we're not sure. And what will happen historically is the cadre will submit yellows. And the boss, if he needs numbers, just takes all the yellows. And then the cadre freak out. Oh my God, you're lowering the standards. And my reply to him is, no, you gave them a yellow, which is to say, not a red. And if it's a yellow, that means you're indifferent. So be indifferent. But if you're not going to be indifferent, then make them a red or make them a green.
It's the first time I've heard you express a binary opinion about anything.
About anything.
But yeah. I have seen that exact thing happen. And usually the way it's resolved is we'll let training sort it out. Which you've already hit it creates its own challenges. You know, and it brings back the mantra that I hear across these entire communities of selection is an ongoing process.
Yeah.
and it gets complicated.
I have a kind of an unwritten rule. Maybe I should write it down. I'll tell everybody now. If you're not losing 5 to 10% of people on your training course, you are being too risk averse in your selection. Meaning you're leaving some meat on the table, meaning that you have actually cut out some people that could have been there, but you're being too conservative. So I would actually recommend that everybody think about at least a 5 to 10% attrition at their training. That would suggest they're taking enough risks in selection and not losing good people. That's just a rule of thumb, but over stepping back and looking at it for years and years and years, that's sort of one of the metrics that I've seen work out. I'm now going to close this up with an idea of this community of praxis. And the way I'm going to explain it is just very simple, is that we've talked about the communitas, which is just the group of instructor cadre, the community, the tribe. Anthropologists call that a communitas, a group that has a shared lived experience. Then we talk about the academics. And the academics are not just psychologists, but they're also the human performance folks. They're a bunch of folks like me as an educator. I would fall on the academic side of the house. And we're the folks that are trying to do predictive analytics. We're trying to give structure. We're trying to help the boss make decisions with good data. We're trying to be fair to the candidates and fair to the cadre. We're actually trying to arbitrate this so that it's sustainable and not seen as arbitrary. But the third sort of leg of that stool that often doesn't get talked about is the leadership. Because the leadership is the one that owns the money, the number of people that they need, and the mission, which is evolving. And ultimately, it's them saying, I'm writing a check to do this because I need X number of people to do X number of kinds of things. And too often, the psychologists or the academics and the communitas will be like, whoa, 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 that's not who we are. And as a reminder to you all, that isn't your job. Your job is to adapt to the next problem set, not to lecture to people on who and what you are. The reason you're in special operations is because the conventional military is not fast enough or agile enough to solve those kinds of problems. And we need you, and I mean that, we need you to stay agile against that problem set. And so a community of praxis is understanding everybody's role, not from a critical lens, but from a generative or additive lens, which is to say, these are actually really key ingredients to really successful decisions. And so where everybody overlaps, it works out brilliantly. And where there's tension, instead of being like, they suck or they hate America or whatever country, instead get curious and go, why is their data different than our data? What are they seeing that we're not seeing? And done well, when this happens, I've seen psychologists go back and check their data. I've seen cadre go back and just check their conversations. Are they in a halos and horns situation? Have they taken somebody and made them the next coming, or that they've scapegoated them? They'll never succeed no matter what. And both of those are bad, quite honestly. And so those are sort of the three categories. And if working together, can be very, very successful, in my opinion.
I agree. And when you say leaders, there are multiple levels of leaders. Throughout this process of supporting the research that you did to write this paper and all the many conversations we've had about it, I feel a very real desire to request that the leaders in psychology be deliberate about the people that they bring into these organizations.
Yeah.
Whether that involves their own internal selection process, whether that involves entry-level opportunities that allow them to get a work sample and they go to dinner with them and they drive across country with them or out to a training area and they get a feel for these psychologists and scientists and academics as people. And since they are often already part of this community, they should have a sense of how well an individual might fit in, assuming that they have at least the baseline credentialing that's needed to wear the hat of psychologist in whatever lane they're in. But I believe that some of that is on the leadership in psychology to weigh in on that, to make those decisions, and to not set people or organizations up for failure and to make this opportunity to come together and unify more difficult than it needs to be.
Yeah.
Because the wrong people are in the wrong positions at the wrong time. And I think that the same thing happens on the cadre side. One of the things that's an interesting phenomenon I've seen over the last couple of years in the selection programs I step in and out of is, since we're no longer in active combat in so many places the way that we were for almost 20 years, we now have really, really effective, high-performing, high-functioning operational individuals in whatever lane they're in, dog handlers, medics, operators, communicators, intelligence folks, all of them, who are not as busy as they were before. And I would argue that you have an opportunity to be a leader in that moment and to step in and go be part of the cadre that develops and finds the next group of people and trains them. And it's not because you've got challenges. It's not because you need a break. All of that can be true, but you can also make the decision simply because you have something to offer that's meaningful and compelling and powerful, particularly if you're of the mindset that we're best when this is a unified effort. I would encourage leaders on both sides to adjust the lens on that and consider the decisions that are being made.
And the problem with selection and assessment, right, is that exceptional work is just a Thursday. That's what's expected. But when it goes bad on either side, when you get an egregiously bad cadre or an egregiously bad psychologist, man, does it fill the windshield, and for very different reasons. When you have a bad cadre, the team will usually rally around them and defend them, even if they know it's wrong, because of the culture. When you have a bad psychologist, it's really problematic for other psychologists to criticize one of their peers. And often the leadership doesn't really know what to do for legal reasons or for HR reasons or a variety of other things. And so they tend to be a lasting problem, which is a shame because they might be one of six, but everyone's talking about the one of six and not the five that are amazing and changing America and the world for better. And that's a conversation that we just need to find a way to have in a very objective way and create some mechanisms so that when that does happen, that we can have a reasonable conversation about it. And that's true for everybody, actually, that's working with special operations. It's just asking the question, how does one get involved? How does one get removed if they need to be? Or how does one get counseled if they need to be? And that isn't always clear depending on what team it is. And I try, if I meet with the commanders, I try to get a question I ask all of them just because I'm curious, right? And the question I asked this time was, now that you've been in this path for a long time and you look back at your selection and assessment, do you believe that people that do well as instructor cadres do better in leadership positions, regardless if it's team leader or officer leader? And every answer was an emphatic yes. They said the lapse of teaching other people and developing other people and learning the craft of developing other people ended up actually translating directly to leading people in chaotic and emergent environments where new things are having to be taught to each other every single day. And so I would simply say to everybody who is interested in progressing in the ranks and being of a significance to their team, that a time that you might be hesitant to go and spend some time in the cadre, to maybe reframe it to understand that it might actually be the thing that allows you to be the kind of leader that you want to be.
Nothing to add other than amen.
So, Art, that was all the major points that I wanted to make, just reviewing the article. I wanted to make a little bit of like, hey, you know, this is some stuff we've discovered since the paper got written, and also just to encourage people who are interested in the subject to take a look at the paper. I didn't know if you had any closing thoughts or clarifications that you wanted, or any stuff about selection that we didn't talk about you think is important.
I've sat in awe of this process for decades now, and just express gratitude to all of the cadre, all of the academics, my psychologist colleagues of all stripes, for the work that they're putting in. Another saying that Paula Camera had was, your impact on the battlefield is not dictated by your proximity to it. And I think that is true of this community we want to help support building and growing and developing, is that you are training the next person, you are selecting the next person, you are influencing the next person who will be facing the next zombie apocalypse. And your efficacy will at one point be tested, but that doesn't diminish your efforts on a regular Thursday.
Yeah. If we look at what an operator really is, what makes them effective is that they have habituated a certain set of skills in such a way that they can maximize their situational awareness in a chaotic situation. In order for them to habituate those skills, they need people from the outside coaching and mentoring them on that skill development. And if done well, this is the important part, if done well, that process for the instructor is very boring. I want to just say this out loud. Done well, the most elite people in the world have to do it a lot, over and over again, consistently. And that seems unattractive, but there is a beauty and there is a wisdom in that that can't be replaced. And I just want to thank all the cadre that I've ever worked with that have demonstrated that over and over again, because the work they're doing is literally contributing to keeping people alive. And while it is boring, you are not forgotten. And I want to thank you all, because it's such important work, even though at times it feels like you're just making the donuts. So with that, gratitude for all the amazing people that have given me opportunity to see their programs, all the amazing programs that are still going on, that we're still supporting. Thank you. And as always, we look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks, Art.
Thank you, Preston.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. If you found value in this discussion, the best way to support our work and ensure you don't miss future episodes is to subscribe and leave us a quick rating or review. It'll help us reach more people who need to hear these conversations. For more on Mission Critical Team Institute, including all of our episodes and show notes, visit missioncti.com. You can also connect with us on LinkedIn. And if you're a Mission Critical Team looking to learn more about our programs, reach out directly to our Director of Operations, Ms. Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's janese@missioncti.com. Until next time, thanks.